Hi guys, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show. I'm your host, Ryan Cartledge, and I'm really excited that you've decided to take time out of your busy schedules to come and hang out with us today. We're really grateful for you tuning in, and if you have been listening to the podcast for a while, we really appreciate this, so thank you very much. Hopefully you have subscribed so that you never miss an episode, but if not, or if you are new to the show, get yourself over to iTunes, Stitcher, animaltrainingacademy.com, or whatever it is you're listening to this podcast on, and hit the subscribe button to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We are bringing you today's episode on behalf of the Animal Training Academy or ATA membership. If you like the conversations in these podcasts, then I want to invite you to continue them with like-minded people within the ATA membership area, which you can find out more about over on the Animal Training Academy website. Some of the ingredients of the membership include a forums with hundreds of training videos and projects where together the community helps problem solve different training situations. We then have the private Facebook group where we share animal training successes, member updates, and relevant content from the web. On top of this, we have WhatsApp chat groups with separate group chats for horses, dogs, cats, birds, exotic animals, and more. And via these groups and direct from your smartphones, you can engage in text message-based conversations with an international community of positive reinforcement animal trainers. And then to top it off, we connect live twice a month in members-only live web classes where we dive even deeper into the topics you will learn about here. To find out more about membership and how you can join the community and carry on the conversation, visit www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click the membership button in the main menu. But we will get started on today's episode where I'm going to be talking to one Chirag Patel. Chirag entered the animal training field professionally in 2004 and has since become a leading figure in the profession internationally. He is highly sought after for consulting with private clients and organizations, as well as running workshops for professionals internationally. Chirag consults on the behavior management and training of domestic animals kept as pets, exotics, zoo, and laboratory animals. His passion is the application of behavior change science and ethics to improve the lives of animals living under human care, especially applying training principles to teach animals to be active participants in their own daily and veterinary care in a stress-free manner. If you want to find out more, you can visit www.domesticatedmanners.com. And without further ado, it's my very great pleasure to welcome one, Chirag Patel, to the show today. Welcome, Chirag.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing extremely well. How are you over there in England?
Fantastic. A little bit cold, but doing great.
We're going to dive straight into the first question today. Could you please take us all back to where you first started to learn about positive reinforcement animal training and maybe share some stories about some of the first animals you ever trained using it?
Sure. So it was really when we got our family pet, Kane, our German Shepherd. We got him when he was 7 months. We'd lost our previous dog a few years before that. And our previous dog, I was really young when we got him. I remember him coming home and he was a German Shepherd too. And almost in every way I remember, he was just like the perfect dog. So he went to a shop. We have a shop. So he went to a shop every day. He came back. He would sit in the driveway in the van with the doors open. We used to take him for a walk. And I wouldn't really recommend people do this, but back then he used to without a lead on. He used to walk to the park, walk back. He was wonderful in every way. And then we got Kane at 7 months, and walking him down the street within the first week, he grabbed hold of someone's arm and bit them. And this happened twice in the first week. And he used to pull on lead. He used to growl and jump on the back of other dogs and grab hold of their neck and shake them. And so it was a big shock from the previous experience that we'd had with Max. So starting to work with Kane and doing some training, we got started with going to an ex-police training school. And there the training methods were quite traditional. And so using a choke chain, pinning dogs down, kneeing them, and sort of much more harsher methods. And that's what I thought was right, what was the best way of working on this and helping Kane, until I went to a dog show. They had this marquee set up, and in that marquee, they had speakers throughout the whole day doing hour slots. And they had so many wonderful people, from Sarah White, head to Ian Dunbar. And Ian Dunbar was one of the final speakers of the day. And I went in that tent in the morning, and I didn't end up leaving the tent for the whole day because I was just fascinated by all this information that I was hearing. And that's quite different to how I'd been training so far. And it was really that last talk that Ian Dunbar gave that I sat there just going, wow. And everything Ian said, it just really made a lot of us like, whoa, that just turned everything on its head. I don't need to be shouting and screaming and my dog's barking. That actually doesn't make sense. Why am I doing that? And so I went away and started reading more about Ian Dunbar's work, his books. And from that, I got references and read The Culture Clash and started looking at training using a different philosophy. So that's really where I suppose positive reinforcement started becoming a focus on my training and my work. And I was very lucky to be able to go out to the States and work with both Ian Dunbar and Gene Donaldson early on. And after that point, I was at a conference and I heard there was a keynote speaker, and her name was Dr. Susan Friedman. And I'd never heard of her before that. And I sat there thinking, oh, I know about learning theory. And then she spoke and I just felt like, oh my God, I don't know anything. There's so much to learn. And it really inspired me to want to look up more. And I emailed Susan asking her for more information about where I could learn more. And that one talk that I heard from her originally really got me thinking about giving animals more control and choice in part of training. And it's not just about positive reinforcement, but actually empowering our learners. And that was a big, huge stepping stone for me. So I think they're some of the big events that have really sort of influenced the way I work.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall as you're sitting there watching Ian Dunbar and watching the cogs turning in your mind. And then you went and met Dr. Susan Friedman. You learned about ABA. And in my career, you're still learning. You're taking that even further now and doing some more learning on applied behavior analysis.
Yeah, so as I started learning more and more, just like this whole idea of learning theory kind of became smaller, and actually thinking there's an actual whole science out there and applied behavior analysis. And so I've become so fascinated by behavior analysis, and I find it so interesting. I'm doing my master's in ABA with a university in Ireland. So yeah, I'm doing more ABA learning at the moment.
Yeah, congratulations on doing your master's. That's really cool. When I hear you talk about going to see Dr. Susan Friedman and thinking, I know about learning theory, and then just having your mind completely blown. Can you just talk to this a little bit for the people listening who think that?
Yeah, so as a young trainer, we're doing so much work. We go to so many courses and we hear people talk about positive reinforcement and learning theory, the quadrant, and we hear it so many times put in a popular way that we almost end up thinking, oh yeah, I know that stuff, or I've heard it so many times. But actually, when you hear it from someone like Dr. Susan Friedman and you suddenly start discovering the whole field of behavior analysis, you realize that actually what we know is just a tiny fraction. And the more I learn, the more I realize how much I don't know. And people do PhDs and postdoc research on specific aspects of reinforcement. So to think that we go to a talk or we read a book and we understand positive reinforcement, there's so much out there and so many nuances that the more we learn, the more we continue to learn. So for me, I think the time when we should stop doing what we do is when we think we know it all, because definitely from my perspective, the more I learn, the more books I read, the more educational events I go to or people I speak to, it just highlights to me how much more there is to learn. And I think that's great because it means we can do what we do much better. We can help the animals and the humans that look after them in a better way. So it really inspires me to want to continue this journey. And for me, it's a really exciting journey.
Yeah, I like that. Sometimes I wake up in the morning and go, yeah, cool. I've got a really great hold on this and my training's going great and I've got a really great understanding. Sometimes I wake up and go, oh my God, like it's scary how little I know.
And I think it's really something we should embrace and something we should be happy about, because we often think of it as a weakness, or we think of it as something that would make us look less bright or less intelligent that we don't know that, or if we wake up or we go to a consult or we read about something, or waking up and thinking, yeah, I know this stuff, it almost makes us feel better. But actually, we should embrace how much there is to learn, because I think there's so much we don't know. And the fact that we're discovering new things and we're learning new things, that's what life is. It's a journey rather than just an end destination. So I think it's something we should definitely embrace and be happy about.
Yeah, and I make the podcast for all of you listening, but at the same time, there's a bit of a selfish endeavor. I get to hang out with people like Chirag Patel on a weekly basis and just blow my mind every time I have these conversations. So really appreciate you coming on here, Chirag, and helping myself and everyone listening to this podcast to take their understanding to the next level.
It's a huge honor to be invited. I think you're doing such an amazing job with the organization. And I remember seeing emails or links or messages on Facebook about the organization and not knowing too much. But even over the last year or 2 years, just the feedback that I hear from some of my students or people that come on courses, they just have the most wonderful things to say. So I think it's great that there's organizations like yourself and the work that you're doing to help further education and make it easy for people to access, because anyone in the world can access your podcasts or the education that you offer. So I think that's wonderful.
Oh, makes me emotional, the thing that you guys are all saying. Those things, I really appreciate that. And for your master's, Chirag, are you doing, you're doing a thesis?
I will be, yes. So I haven't decided yet exactly what I'll do, because I'm still through the taught component aspects of it. But towards the end, yeah, I will definitely be doing a thesis. And so I've got a little bit of time to think about exactly what I want to focus on or study in more detail.
Can you share what your musings are, or is it kept under a tight lid?
No, it's not necessarily under a tight lid. I just think there's so many things in terms of, like, every time I have this conversation, there's like 1,000 things on the list. And where do I even start? And then sort of next week, I'll be having a conversation with someone else and think, oh my God, that's exactly what I want to be doing. Everything from looking at cues in more detail or looking at certain things in zoos. And so one conversation I was having with someone in a zoo recently was, so when people walk by exhibits or enclosures, how effective is it? So when the person walks in terms of they buy a ticket, they walk into the zoo, from the moment they leave, what behavior changes occurred in terms of long term? So the way the environment's set up, is it the best way to set the environment up, or what things can we do differently? So looking at that side of things as well, from a human behavior change perspective. There's so many different angles, but maybe some of the listeners can message me with more ideas and I can add them to my list.
Yeah, comment on this on social media, or go to mrkedmanners.com, or comment on the podcast write-up and we'll choose your master's thesis. No, we won't, but that sounds absolutely fascinating. Can you bring everyone listening now, though, up to speed? Where are we in 2018? You're running your own business. What else are you up to at the moment?
So what am I up to? I am doing lots of workshops. I'm really lucky that people want to attend these workshops and ask me to go and visit them and the organizations and help consult, whether it's a laboratory housing research animals or a zoo housing animals, in those situations are pets. So a large part of my time is spent consulting. I'm also working on a few projects. We've just finished filming for a TV show, which I can't give too much information about at the moment, but hopefully that will be out in the UK this year, and that will help spread the message about positive reinforcement, giving animals choice and control. So that will be an exciting little project. And then there's a conference that I run every so often called Wolf. So we're just working on planning the next Wolf for 2019 at the moment. So yeah, there's loads of things going on.
And where can people go? Make sure we say this a couple of times in this podcast. We'll say it right at the end as well before we finish. But just let people know at the moment where they can go to get in touch with you and find out more information about upcoming events and Domesticated Manners.
Yeah, people can go to the website domesticatedmanners.com, or I use Facebook quite a lot. So if they go to facebook.com/Chirag Patel DM, then they'll access my professional page, which I usually update with new events, and they can contact me through that link as well.
Cool. And we'll make sure to link to all the stuff in the podcast write-up as well. And excited about this TV program. The more TV programs we can bring out on this stuff, the better, obviously, to be a contrast to some of the stuff available. And exciting about Wolf, is Wolf an acronym, Chirag?
No, a friend of mine came up with when we were working on this project originally, and it was just something short and easy to say and something that would intrigue people. What's all that about? And it was going to originally focusing on the dog community, but now it's more about behavior science and the application to learning, whether it's a dog or a wild animal or human. So yeah.
And when's the next Wolf conference?
We're planning for February 2019.
Exciting. Can you share any more details about...
Oh, we don't speak it. Hopefully in the next 2 weeks, we'll have information about speakers and the exact dates confirmed. So if people keep an eye on the Facebook page or the website, then they'll be the first to know. So definitely they can even send us a message on domesticatedmanners.com, and we can email them out soon in the next couple of weeks with the information.
Cool. And whereabouts is that going to be located?
That will be in the UK. So most likely it'll be in Nottingham, where we held the last Wolf at a conference center there. And so that will be, yeah, February 2019.
So wonderful. And I love hearing about people's what I call behavioral odysseys. So thank you very much for sharing. Moving forward, I would really like to talk about one of your, I don't know if training techniques is the right word to use here, but let's go with that for now. Correct me if you want to phrase it in a different way. One of your training techniques that you've come up with, and this is the bucket game. Can you please tell people listening, what is the bucket game, how it works, and what makes it such an efficient tool for people to use?
Sure. So the bucket game is something that I've been doing for a number of years, and it started with Kane. So my German Shepherd used to bite people, had to be sedated at the vets when he first went. So working on voluntary vet behaviours with him kind of started building that protocol, and also things that I've learned from many other wonderful trainers and behaviorists. The bucket game isn't anything new in terms of I haven't invented a new principle or a new method. I've just kind of taken principles that are already out there and maybe sort of made a cocktail which might be slightly different to what's been done before. And so the bucket game is about choice and empowering our learners and giving them a voice. So we want the animal to be able to say start, stop, yes, no, and making it quite clear for the human learner and also the animal learner. So with the bucket game, we use a target, and the target is usually a visual target, a container of food. And what we do is we start off by teaching the learner, the animal, to orient towards the bucket or the container and holding a calm posture, calm body language, standing there in a relaxed way, and just focusing towards that pot. Now, the pot, the target, doesn't need to have anything in there, but we do put food in there to start with. Reason being is if we're going to use food as a reinforcer, we might as well teach our learners how to behave around that food, because if they're trying to jump towards the food, if they're trying to get into the pot of food or your treat bag, then when you're stopping them, then that's going to interfere with your reinforcement delivery. It's going to affect, it could poison the food that you're using. So one of the things that we do is we start off with a pot of food held at a distance and arranged in a way that minimizes the mistake. So it could be, say, if we've got a dog with us, we could have a baby gate up and we could hold the bucket or a pot of food at a height where the dog's not even going to try and jump. But the moment we bring the pot out, the dog's gate orients towards the bucket. And so the moment they look, we can mark and reinforce. And so every time they see that pot at height, they just look towards the pot, they get reinforced. Now, there's no verbal cues. There's no sit, stay, down, leave, don't touch. We don't give them any kind of previously learned behaviors to engage in. All they're doing is a pot comes out, a bucket comes out, and the animal orients towards it and they get reinforced. And we develop a station behavior. Now, for me, I want to think about the long-term physiology, anatomy of the animal, as well as their learning history and how that's going to influence, not just so when we train a behavior, I don't want it to be something that we do and the animal can do now, but it affects them negatively in the future. So for example, if I have a dog and I'm going to teach them to station by sitting or standing, I have to be aware that as that dog gets older, or even tomorrow when they wake up, if they've got a sore leg, then sitting might be slightly uncomfortable for them. So I want to try and give them choices that allow them to engage, but not necessarily be so restrictive that if they've got arthritis down the line, it kind of puts them into conflict. So what I do is I say, when we teach a station, let's give the animal a couple of options. So they orient towards the bucket, but they can choose to do it lying down, sitting, or standing. And so I often say, orient to the bucket with 4 feet on the floor. And that can, like I say, that can be sitting, lying down, or standing. So a dog can choose which one they do. Then we lower the bucket slightly so that it can be put onto a surface or it can be put down onto the floor and you don't have to have it in your hand. Now, when we're teaching this exercise, what happens is by the time we bring the bucket lower, if at any point we bring it too low and the animal engages in the behavior we didn't want, say jumping towards the bucket, all we need to do is go back a previous step to raising the bucket slightly higher. So by doing that, we're not punishing the behavior that's just happened. We're not trying to remove something the animal wants to get at. But what we're doing is we're just giving an established cue, because already you've practiced holding the bucket high, the animal looks up, they get lots of reinforcement. So now as you lower the bucket, if there's a mistake that happens, rather than saying, I'm going to hide the bucket, or I'm going to say or no, all we do is we give us a cue which has had previously successful repetitions by holding it slightly higher. The animal orients, gets success, we reinforce, and then we just reapproximate bringing that bucket down until it can be at a height where, like I say, it's on an object surface or on the floor. We're also watching body language, and so we're teaching it in a way where the animal's calm, they're relaxed, and the animal isn't standing there trying to jump into the bucket or shaking and shivering around that. And so by the time it's on that surface, the animal's just quite relaxed. They've learned if they just stand and look at the bucket, good things happen. If the animal chooses to look away from the bucket or they look in a different direction, then we just allow that. We don't say anything, we don't rattle the bucket, and we tend to use plastic, little plastic buckets, because they don't make a lot of noise, and also they're easy to crunch up and put into a pocket or bring out relatively easily without making lots of noise. Because if the dog is turning around and sniffing their butt, or they've decided rather than looking at the bucket they want to look at the opposite end of the room, that's fine. All we're doing is we're allowing the animal to look at the environment, and this, what we call distractions, become less reinforcing because the animal's had a chance to look. So when they're ready, they look back at the bucket, and then it actually is more valuable because they've had a chance to do whatever else they needed to do. The other thing is, if they do disengage, and rather than trying to distract them back, we think what we're doing is not reinforcing the behavior that we want. So potentially what we need to do is change what we're using as a reinforcer to make sure it's strengthening the behavior that we want. So by the time we've got to the point at this, what I call stage one, where the bucket's on the floor, on a level, on a surface, anytime the bucket comes out, we've got an animal that runs towards it, stands or sits or lies down calmly, focusing towards the bucket. And you often see sort of body language which suggests the animal's relaxed and happy. And there's so much repetition and reinforcement that's gone into this. We've almost started to build a great relationship with the caregiver, where previously there might have been negative experiences, or at the vets, bad things have happened. So when this bucket comes out, there's safety attached to the bucket. There's lots of positive reinforcement, great emotional states. And so that's the first step. Then what we do is we start teaching the animal about this conversation. So when the bucket goes down onto the surface, we just stand and wait. When the animal looks at the bucket, we might move our fingers on our lap or move our hands slightly. And if the animal orients towards our hands, we just move our hands straight back onto our lap. If the animal continues looking towards the bucket as our fingers move, we mark and we reinforce them. And I generally tend to reinforce on the floor or in front of the bucket rather than from my hands, because I want the animal to, rather than be orienting at my hands and I'm touching them or examining them, just to keep looking forward towards the bucket. And what this starts doing is it starts teaching the animal, I can get those human hands to move and I can get the human hands to stop moving, because if they orient towards the bucket in a relaxed way, those hands continue moving and they get reinforced. If they look at the hands return back to us almost like baseline or station, the lap. And so if the animals want to stop the hands, they just have to look away from the bucket and those hands stop moving. And so it gives the animal some more control of the environment. And it's quite predictable because they don't have to be trying to work out what aspect or what bit of body language for new people. So if they've been practicing with me and they go to the vet, the rules are still the same. Those hands either stop moving or they start moving, contingent on what the animal's doing. And basically that's the basic premise of the bucket game. And then we build up to teaching those hands start moving around the learner and pretending to look at the ears, pretending to touch, pretending to groom, until we can get close enough to be able to touch them and look in the ears. And we can even use the bucket game to teach the learner to tell us when we can pick up eardrops or things like that. So say I have the bucket down and I have some eardrops either next to the bucket or further away, depending on the animal's history with those eardrops. And so when the animal orients to the bucket, my hands start moving towards the eardrops. And if my hands move, make an approximation to the eardrops and the dog continues looking at the bucket, they get reinforced. If they turn around and they look towards me, my hands just go back on my lap. Now, if the animal does turn around and look at my hands, that gives me information. It potentially tells me that my criteria might be too high, so I need to reduce the criteria slightly. So if I go to move my hand within 2 centimeters of the eardrops and the animal keeps turning around and looking, I'm not just going to keep repeating the same thing. I'm going to reduce my criteria. So I might move my hand towards the eardrops but stop a lot further away, so the animal can continue being comfortable looking at the bucket and not need to tell me to stop moving my hands towards those eardrops. So eventually what will happen is the animal look at the bucket, I can pick the whole bottle of eardrops, take it towards the ear, and if at any point they want to stop, rather than having to snap, growl, bite, run away, all they need to do is just turn their head and the bottle gets put back down. And this builds a lot of trust. It allows the animal to have control over the environment, which is what they're born to do. And so I find that for new caregivers, for people who are not necessarily the most experienced, if they can't read the animal the best, or are working with a caregiver who's not a professional, at least they can be watching, is the dog's head looking at the bucket or is it not looking at the bucket? And later on, as they become more interested in this game, they can start to look for more nuanced bits of body language and become less about just the head position, but watching the whole animal and the whole learner. And then one other aspect which we add into this, it's not just about food in the bucket. So we're not working with animals saying the only way you can get food is by accessing the bucket or looking at the bucket, we want to make sure that they can get food from other places. So often when I'm working on this, I'll have a stuffed Kong, or I'll have a puzzle feeder, or I'll have a snuffle mat with food in there, or scattered bits of food on the floor. So if the animal doesn't find it very reinforcing staying with me, if I'm not doing a good enough job maintaining that behavior with me, or if they need a break, they can walk off and go and pick the stuffed Kong up. And what we find is a lot of animals will walk off, go play with the Kong, or go get some of the free food on the floor. But actually, they find it much more reinforcing to come back and play the game for the same type of food. But because they're almost contra freeloading, they're doing something and they're being able to control the outcomes, and they find that reinforcing too.
You said they're almost contra freeloading. Can you build on that?
Yeah, so contra freeloading, there's research that demonstrates that given the opportunity, so if, say, you've got an animal, say a bird, and there's a pot of food, some nuts, and there's a container where they have to manipulate the container for the nut to be released. Given certain conditions, those animals will most often leave the free bowl of food and walk over and manipulate an object or press a button or do something for the nut to be released. And one of the theories behind this is that by just having the bowl of food there, they're not really doing anything. There's nothing they have to do to control an outcome. Whereas by walking over and pressing a button or lifting up a little lid, the animal engages in a behavior and it pays off, and they can control the environment in some way. So it allows them to actually have some small element of control over the environment. And often we'll find animals will leave free food and actually spend time engaging in little tasks where they will actually get the same food that's available to them freely, but by doing a small task or doing something. And so it just gives them another opportunity to be able to engage in behaviors and be able to control the environment and gain outcomes.
And you mentioned that this is great for people who might not necessarily be starting with the best trust with the animal.
Yeah.
With the highest trust accounts.
Yeah.
Have you found that over time in these situations, if the dog or the animal has an option to go and get food for free, that the frequency of behaviors shift with regards to how relationships develop? Or have you found that the animals engage consistently in the bucket game and that choice to, or the ability to have choice from the start? Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. So I find that, like, depending on the environment, so it could be if we're making something, or if we're making it harder for the animal to succeed. So sometimes I could be doing a training session, and whether I've had a bad day or whether, for whatever reason, I'm not setting up the environment best for my learner to learn. And what's great is the animal just goes, okay, forget you. I'm just going to walk over and play with that stuffed Kong. Whereas often when we teach or we train, we say we're positive reinforcement trainers and we make it sound like we've hit the gold standard, but we haven't, because I can say I'm teaching my dog or my parrot or my horse using positive reinforcement, but the animal doesn't have anywhere else to go because they're in a stable or they're in a cage, or my dog either interacts with me where I've got a clicker and some treats, or there's no other way for them to access that food, because if they want the food, they have to interact towards me. Whereas as soon as we put that stuffed Kong out while we're training with food, now we're going to have to do a better job motivating and making it reinforcing for the learner to stay with us. We're not just relying on that food to keep the animal there, if that makes sense. So what starts happening is it really makes us better what we do and takes the onus off. The animal has to do this. And even though we say we're using positive reinforcement, for me, that's not the gold standard. It's about really empowering our learners, giving them choice and control. And also, we want the animal to really want to be there. So I think by if we're using a toy, having some free toys on the floor as well, then seeing if the animal, how we can arrange the environment so the animal wants to work with us and the toy as opposed to just pick up the free toys and play with those, is what we want to be doing. So it's not just about saying we're using positive reinforcement. We really want to live that, and we want to motivate the animals to want to be there. So if we make a mistake, then the animal doesn't have to suffer. So if we're making it too hard, the animal doesn't have to keep failing and then have to get frustrated because they failed. The animal can simply just walk off and pick up a stuffed Kong or go and find treats doing something else.
And do you normally put the same food items or toys or whatever reinforcer you're using, do you use the same items or do you mix it up or do you use different ones in the toys and the Kongs? And
it varies. So I'll often try and start with the same food that I've got with me in the stuffed Kong or in a puzzle feeder, or just attached to the branches. There's some other nuts and things that they can access by interacting with the toy, so they can do something else to get similar food items. But then I may also have, depending on how I'm training the individual learner, I might have a different variety of food on me compared to what's in the puzzle feeder. Sometimes it's the same. So it depends on the individual learner in front of me and also the environment and some other factors. So that varies. But I will, at the minimum, I won't always do most boring food in the puzzle feeder and then have cheese or something really exciting on me. I'll try and have some of what I've got or the same value of what I've got in the puzzle feeder too.
Fantastic. And everything you've just said there about the bucket game was beautifully described. I think you did a really wonderful job of helping people and helping me as well understand what the bucket game is and why it's helpful. And you said it's great for maybe people teaching others. It's a great kind of exercise to get pet owners or people new to animal training started. Would you say that?
Definitely, yes. Because like I say, it relies less about what the animal already understands, or we think the animal already knows or understands, by saying, oh, he knows what sit means or what leave means. So when I hold out the food, I'm just going to say leave, because we're not using any of the verbal cues that we've taught previously. We're just basically starting afresh. And also it really gets new learners, human learners, focused on a hands-off way of teaching, but also learning about the animal does have a voice in this conversation. It's not about I do, you listen, or you have to do what I tell you. It's about the human learner learning to use their behavior, arrange the environment so that the animal learner wants to engage in this conversation. And also from a new trainer, a new learner coming into this field, I think it's so important that they learn. It's not just about we can control behavior, but it's about respecting the individual organism in front of us, the individual learner, and that's just as important. So I think training has become too much about, oh, I can do this and I can change the behavior, and we've almost lost, or we're losing, let's take a step back and actually understand our learner and observe what we're seeing and what we've got in front of us before we intervene. So too often people say, oh, the dog's jumping up, let's just teach 4 feet on the floor. But have we stopped to look at how the animal behaves? How do they jump up? What's the function of that behavior before we start deciding what we're going to do to change that behavior? What is the function of jumping up? So for one animal, it could be gaining escape or avoidance. Now, if we just teach 4 feet on the floor, how does that allow that learner to still have a voice to say, I want to escape or avoid this situation? So I think using a game like the bucket game to teach new trainers or caregivers really teaches respect for the animal, and also makes them a better learner, because they learn they can't just make the animal do things, then they have to respect that conversation.
I love it. And we're going to move on, but I just have a few more things I want to build on before we do. You said right at the start of your answer there that this isn't a new concept. You didn't come up with this concept. You used the word cocktail. Yeah. You created a kind of a new cocktail of thinking about this. Back then, let's go back to when you started to first think about doing the bucket game, what's evolved to be the bucket game. Right at the start, were you thinking about all of those things like the long-term? You mentioned the long-term thinking about what's most comfortable for the dog and using, I think you said, a plastic bucket so it doesn't make as much noise. Was that kind of stuff that's evolved as the bucket game's evolved, or did you kind of think through all of this stuff right at the start?
Yeah, so no, this was a journey, and during different stops of this journey, the bucket game has developed and is still developing. I think if it's something that I say, well, this is it and that's done, then there's something wrong with that, because as my knowledge changes and my learning changes, so I'm hopefully going to know different things to what I know now in 2 weeks or in 6 months' time. And so I want to constantly be updating what I would call the bucket game based on new learning and new information. So I think it's an evolving program all the time, and the principles of giving choice and control underlie that, but it's the way we apply it, the art part of it. Like, people email me videos of them doing bucket game or their version of the bucket game, and you have the underlying science, but you've also got the artistry, the way people apply it, and you think, oh, that's fantastic, and that could work really well in this situation. So I think it's something that's continually developing and progressing. And originally the bucket game didn't really have a name. It was just something I would teach and I would use in lots of different situations. And I'm not a big fan of just labeling something and saying this is it, do it, because for me, when we do something or we apply something, we do it for a reason. And we, first of all, we want to understand what we're seeing in front of us. We want to understand the behavior before we try and change it. So I don't want people to say, well, this is it and this is the recipe sheet, because those recipe sheets need to be customized and changed. A good chef is able to take some ingredients and say, well, I can decrease this, I can increase this spice, I can do this with this ingredient, and they can really change it. Whereas someone who doesn't really understand cooking to that level can put together one recipe, but they won't know how to really customize or change that recipe according accordingly. I want trainers and animal caregivers to be able to customize those recipes. I was teaching at a workshop and we used to just use containers like plastic pots. And I was in the States and I went to Target and they had a dollar section and they had some buckets. And they were originally little metal buckets. And so I thought, oh, they would work well for that exercise. So I bought them and I was traveling around different places. And I was teaching at Tilly Farm, which is Sarah Fisher, a fantastic trainer in the UK. And she's a T-Touch practitioner. She runs a lot of the T-Touch stuff in the UK. I was teaching with her a couple of years ago and she almost kind of saw the game that we were playing as an exercise. And she goes, oh, what's that bucket game thing that you're playing? And she said, have you seen these plastic buckets? They seem quite convenient. We could try and use those rather than the metal buckets. I thought that was a genius idea. And then from that kind of, she tweeted about what she'd seen during that workshop or what we'd been learning. And she was working with a dog at a dog's home in the UK. They were thinking about putting the dog to sleep because they'd run out of options or choices, or they're thinking there's not much they can do. And so after the workshop, she was consulting at this organization and she decided to use what we now call the bucket game in that situation and had great results. And so she has a great following. She was tweeting about it. So after she tweeted, the kind of people were like, oh, what's this bucket game thing that you're talking about? We want to learn more about it. And that's how the name kind of came about, the bucket game. And so, yeah, it's an evolving journey. And for people who come on workshops or come to sort of events that I teach, if they came last year, the year before, and then they come next year, they're probably going to hear a different version or slightly upgraded version of the bucket game based on the new information that I've developed or that I've learned.
So keep tuned for a bucket game version 2018.
Exactly. It's going to be something that's continually changing with the knowledge and information that we gain.
Yeah, I'm excited that, you know, people are a part of this journey as well. And it's now a community project.
Yeah, definitely. And it's something that I don't want people to think you have to have a bucket, because actually when we really focus on it's about the underlying principles, it's the target that we're using or a station behavior. And often when people teach a station behavior, they teach one behavior. And so they teach the animal to station, what they label as stationing. But then if the animal isn't doing that specific behavior, they will often re-cue. So for an example is if I have a dolphin in front of me and the station behavior for the dolphin is to be in a vertical position with the head out, with the eyes out of water, facing towards like just in front of me. If that dolphin is turning around or they're lying on their side or they're looking in a different direction, then for me, part of the principles of bucket game is I just wait for a moment. So if the animal's looking around, I don't say touch or watch or look at me, or I don't cue them to restation, because when they're turning around and they're looking away from you, they're doing something else, that behavior has function. It could be they want to escape or avoid having a conversation with me because it's not very reinforcing, it's punishing. Or it could be that an animal over there is giving off signals that might be made worse if this animal turns away, or the animal showing slightly aggressive behavior. So this animal doesn't want to turn and look at me because they need to be focusing on what's going on over there. It could be that they're slightly uncomfortable, they're in pain. And so rather than just coming to a training session and saying, well, the animal isn't stationing, so I'm going to give a cue. And because it's positive reinforcement, I'm holding out a target stick and the animal touches a target, I click and treat. Hold on a second. Why was the animal in the first place looking around or doing something else which didn't meet that focus to the bucket or focus to the trainer behavior? And so for me, it's those underlying principles that we use that form the bucket game. It's not necessarily you have to have a bucket. Think about how what we teach influences the animal's physical structure. So if it's a small dog and part of their station behavior is to have head up and look towards us, and we're doing that 6-7 times a day, then how are we influencing how that neck, the muscles around the neck, will develop? So are we allowing the animal to be able to be comfortable as they get older as well in the way we're asking them to behave? So it's all of those different underlying principles.
I like how you referred to training and the art of training as having a recipe and versus being a good chef. And just before we move on, that's probably one of the most said things in these podcast episodes. I'm good at dragging out these questions. Just before we move on, one more thing, because I think this is important. I think creativity is super important for everyone to work on and to develop, and helps us be better and good trainers. So I just want to go back once again to when you started and share with us potentially, but maybe this is a bit of a hard question, how your mind was working, or even now, how your mind works when you look at a situation and you talked about figuring out what the function is for the animal there and making sure that's accommodated for. But how do you kind of look at a situation and come up with a new idea? Like, how did you start moving towards the bucket game? What's the creative process inside Shurag's head? I know, as I said, that potentially this is a hard question, but I think it's valuable for people to kind of learn about how other people be creative so they can hopefully flex that muscle themselves.
You know, definitely. I think it's a really good question, because often when people think of creativity, I think they think of either someone's creative or they're not, or it kind of pops out of nowhere. But I don't necessarily think that's true. I think a behavior analysis can provide some good answers. And Skinner actually did a lecture and wrote an article called On Having a Poem. And it discusses about writing a poem and where that some of that creativity could come from, but understanding it from more of a learning history point of view. And from my point of view, for me, thinking about it is when I've been put into environments where I've accessed or learned from people who have provided certain bits of information, and then I've been able to use those different things that I've learned. And given a certain situation, maybe I've learned something here and I've learned something there, and I thought, oh, I could put both of those together and try, and it's been reinforced, it's been successful. And also when I work with different people, you talk about different ideas and I think, oh yeah, that's great, and it starts becoming reinforcing when you've got an environment where people are reinforcing you, or and they're going, oh yeah, that's excellent, actually you think about it, they're giving you the opportunity to discuss things rather than just saying, this is how it's done, that's it, this is what you have to learn, here's a textbook, go away. Nope, this is what he says in the textbook. People are open to having discussions, and they're open to discussing, oh yeah, yeah, explain that in a bit more detail. What does that look like? Rather than almost punishing. So when a young student says or asks a question from their mentor, or they say something, too often we'll be very quick to say, yes, but, or we'll say, no, this is how it works, rather than encouraging, oh, okay, this sounds a little bit different to what I'm used to hearing, but let's reinforce this behavior from this learner in front of us and have them be creative, have them explain this idea. So in the future, they're more open to exploring things from a different angle, as opposed to just the angle that we're teaching them from. And it could have been they've read a different book, or they've been exposed to something different to what we've been exposed to, and they're able to see it from different eyes. And so I think the creativity is born. So I feel I've been lucky enough to be around environments, people who I've been lucky to call mentors, that have been very open and encouraged me to constantly be asking questions. And that's part of science, is to constantly be asking questions. Don't accept anything as the absolute truth, because science is, technology is developing all the time. The information that we learn is developing. So if we just always think, yep, I know it, that's it, then we're going to fall behind and we're never going to be up to date. So constantly questioning what we know as the truth and asking those, I think, can be really useful. Now, when I look at a situation, we have good data from behavior science, the research about how behavior is a result of its environment and the consequences, and how consequences influence behavior, our antecedent arrangement influences behavior. And so when I see a situation, or if I go into a situation, I always start with, okay, the science. What does the science say? What information do we have? And from there, I kind of explore further. And often people will say, we're looking for something more advanced, or we've tried the basics and it just doesn't seem to work. I always come from the angle that the fundamentals have never failed me. And the research, the information, if they do fail, it's often because we haven't applied it well enough, or we're not doing a great job at the way we apply it, or the situations we're applying it in. So rather than thinking, well, this doesn't work, I know positive reinforcement works and it has never failed me, but often it may be the way I'm applying it that's not the best for that situation or correcting that situation. So it just needs to be me learning how to do it better. So that's how I tend to look at situations. So for me, that science is really important. And then from there, I think that allows you to build and be more creative with the basic principles.
Just one more thing before we move on. No, yeah. I'm just joking. we're just looking at the time. We should move on. We could do a whole podcast now, I'm thinking, on the bucket game. But we're going to move on in the conversations that spin from the bucket game to the next question. It was really, really wonderful to hear about that. And thank you for sharing. But I wanted to move on, though, to something that you and I were discussing when we caught up via a Skype call a couple of weeks ago in preparation for this podcast. And this is about speed when we're training. And the potential benefit of sometimes taking things a little bit more slowly when we're engaging with our learner. Can you talk to this idea, please, Shrek?
Definitely. I think For me, a huge part of teaching and learning is slowing down and taking in the information in front of us. I think we're often too quick to jump into situations, and it's almost we're not living in the present moment, but we're thinking about the future. We're thinking about the end goal or the end result as opposed to what we've got in front of us. So often we'll ignore or we don't see what's in front of us because we're so focused on that end destination. We want to teach the animal this, or we want to get to this point, that we lose what's right there in front of us. By slowing down, we see so much more. We get to see what the learners are actually doing and how they offer behaviors which we wouldn't see otherwise. So if we have a dog in front of us or a bird, often I'll hear people say that animal's really fast and so we have to train faster. Or I've worked with wild animals where they say if we slow down they'll bite us, or with these types of animals you can't be slow, you have to be really fast because the animal's really fast. Well, we're never really going to be able to be as fast as that animal. They're going to be able to move faster than us. So trying to speed up is probably setting up the environment for us to fail. Whereas often those animals can learn to slow down, and they often do slow down. If we watch, say, corvids, a lot of times I'll hear corvid trainers say, oh, the corvid never sits still, or they're hyperactive, or they move really fast. And so when they approach the enclosure, the animal's jumping around, moving place to place. And if I say, well, let's reinforce the animal for standing or stationing calmly. Well, no, it's a corvid. They don't do that. If we take a step back and we just watch them from outside their enclosure, do we ever see the raven or the crow just standing and stopping? If we watch a wild raven or a crow, do you ever see them just standing still for a moment? And the answer to that is yes. I can look out a window and see a corvid moving slow. I can see them standing still. So why is it that when we're there, they move really fast? Because we're influencing their behavior. So it must be something that we're doing through the consequences and the way we arrange the environment. That means the animal is what we label as more hyperactive. So we can change that environment to teach the animal to slow down, and it actually pays off to slow down. But also for me is when we're working animals and we're working them really fast, so we're constantly just get them to focus on touching a target stick, click treat, do this behavior, click treat, do this behavior, click treat. Sometimes we almost end up with animals who learn around humans, it's the safest thing is to look for the next cue and follow that cue. And while the animal's doing that, we see what we label as confident body language. In the day-to-day situation, so let me put a practical example here. I remember working with someone who's got some foxes and wolves. And when those animals are hitting targets, so they're going to stations, or they're getting onto a station and they're engaging in a behavior, their body language is a lot more confident and looks very relaxed and happy. But when they're moving from point A to point B to get to those stations, you often see less relaxed body language. And so what we want to teach animals to do is slow down and be able to learn about the environment around them. We want them to be able to go, okay, this is the kind of floor, that's the noise, this is what's happening, oh, there's a black bag over there, this is how it moves. And they relax, they learn about those things. And then when they're focused on us and they're doing things, it's not that we're distracting them from the environment, but they're now able and ready to process what's in front of them. Whereas too often, I think we shove treats in front of the animal and keep them busy, but we distract them from learning about the environment they're in. And if the animal can learn about the environment they're in and feel relaxed, then I think they're less likely to show aggressive behaviors or suddenly just startle or run off, and they're going to relax a lot more quickly. So when we're socializing animals early on, rather than be distracting them with food, allowing them to behave, putting them into situations that aren't going to freak them out, but exposing them to small intensities of certain stimuli, and then reinforcing them for relaxing or being calm, and allowing them to investigate things rather than just having food there the whole time. So they're just focused on the food, but they can manipulate objects and learn about them. We're going to have much more of a confident learner, a learner who can operate on the environment rather than just be focused on that food all the time. So I think that's one aspect of slowing down that's really, really important. And then from a trainer point of view, I think what we end up doing is we really learn more about the individual in front of us, and it's less about that end goal or getting to that destination, but the journey becomes more important, and we get better relationships, really enjoy spending time with our animals, and whether they get the end goal is actually that important, because what we think is we've had a great time, the animals had a great time in those training sessions, and then we have another opportunity to try again. So if I'm working an animal, if something goes wrong, I'd rather just leave the session where the animals had a great time, because next time I open up opportunities to have that conversation, the animal's going to come and want to have a conversation. It gives me another opportunity to try again. Whereas if it's going wrong, but I try getting to my end goal regardless, the next time I open the window for the conversation, the animal's probably not going to want to come back. And And so I always want to try and think through my training sessions. I just want another opportunity with the animal. Next time I give the animal an opportunity to come and have a conversation, they want to come and interact with me or talk to me.
So I find this really interesting. It's about thinking about what's happening in the present moment as opposed to our end goals. And I guess when we're so close to our own training, sometimes it's hard to see what's going on right in front of us because we're just so attached to it. And that end goal is something we think about a lot. Would you say that's something you've found with trainers?
Yeah, definitely. And that includes myself. And so we're always living a lot in the past and the future, but rarely in the now. There's a really good book, nothing to do with animal training, called The Power of Now. And it's about mindfulness. And that really opened my eyes to thinking, if I pick up the clicker or I pick up a training tool and I'm working with the learner, is the voice in your head, what your mind is talking to you, the noise that it's making, thinking about, well, this needs to happen and this needs to happen and I need to do this. And even if it's not about the training session, you're often thinking about, well, I need to go pick up the kids. Or I need to go to do this. I need to shop. I need to do that. I need to order that. And so we're rarely in that moment of the now. And when we're working with animals, I think it's so important to really be in the now and rather than thinking, well, I need to get here, really be focusing on what's happening in front of us and making the most of that. Because once that moment is gone, you're never going to get that now back. So what you're doing with the learner, if all you're focusing on is getting to that end goal, you're spending that 5 or 10 minute training session and you're not really happy until you've got that end goal. Whereas if every moment that you have with that learner, the animal, is about the now and you celebrate that now every single moment, so every single approximation, everything you're doing with that learner is something you enjoy and you celebrate. It's not just about when you get to that end behavior. You've actually spent time with the animals that we love and we care for and we've enjoyed it rather than thinking I've had victory when I've got to the end. When the animals learn that mouth open behavior, when they've got the blood draw, we've had great success. Actually for me, that every session, even before we get to that blood draw, those moments, those nows, we've made the most of. The animals had a great time. They've loved those sessions. I've had a great time. I've loved those sessions. It hasn't been about, well, now we've got a blood draw, so we succeeded. Every moment is almost success the way we create it.
And some people potentially find themselves in situations. We might dive into a I don't know if it's, we could label it as a gray area. Let's just call it a gray area and feel free to rephrase it. Some people might find themselves in a situation where that's really challenging for them. They might have managers above them who are pressuring them to get animals ready for whatever purpose, let's say animal for education program in a zoo.
Yeah.
How can we kind of incorporate this information and manage those situations? I know that's a pretty challenging question. What's your input on that?
So I think we have to arrange our environments up for success and we need to be thinking about, okay, so I go to work and I do it because I love caring for these animals and I enjoy spending time with them. And then you have the manager's role, which is they need to have certain things done or there's certain things happening. So these are the goals that you need to meet. And it was something a trainer said to me. Her name is Jessica, and hopefully she won't mind me mentioning this. She works at the Shedd Aquarium in Chicago. She's a senior trainer there, and it used to be where Ken Ramirez used to be based. And what I really love, so we're having dinner once at Jessica's house, and she said to me, the way I see my job is to go into work and to make my animals happy, to give them what they need, to care for them. And I thought that was such a great way. This is a trainer who's been working with these animals for over 20 years, and she's worked her way up to senior trainer. And the stuff that she enjoys is working animals day to day and caring for them. And so she goes, it's my job. And it's what she was taught by her mentors and the people that she learned from. And Ken Ramirez is a phenomenal trainer. This is something I've picked up from his philosophy is if you're employed as an animal trainer or as an animal caregiver, you're the voice for that animal. So when your managers come to you and say, well, we need to do 8 shows a day, or today we need to do 16 interactions, or we need this behavior by this date, you're the animal's voice. We need to be there rather than bowing down and saying, well, okay, we're going to do anything and compromise welfare to get there. We have to be the ones that stand up for the animals. So almost if our goal and our job is animal care, then that's what we should be really focused on. And then it's a manager's job to do it in a way that doesn't compromise the animal's welfare. And often in lots of places, that's really hard to do. And so I think when I hear trainers say to me, well, I work in this organization, I'm here, and I really can't make these changes, or this is what I have to do, then you have to ask yourself, okay, so that's your job, that's what you go in and do. It's not something you can change now, but is it something that you can work to changing in the future? It might be in 6 months' time or a year's time, or is it something that you feel is not the right situation for you? So from my point of view, I know that I love what I do. I love consulting because I can make my rules up and I can decide how I'm going to do things. I can decide decide which organizations I'm going to work with, which organizations I'm not going to work with, but I don't have to spend time ever in my life saying, well, I had to do this, I had to go into work. If I hear myself saying that, or if I've got friends who hear me saying, I had to do this, I hope they'll say to me, well, do something different then, because I don't want to spend precious moments of my life having to be complaining when I could make changes. So if I consult, I can go and move place to place and say, I really love working with this organization because, yes, they may do things differently to the way I would do things, but they're progressive, they're changing, and over time, things are going in a different direction. So I love spending time working there. Whereas if I go somewhere and they say, yeah, that's all good, but actually, we can't do this or we can't do that, then I'm all for spending time and problem solving and saying, well, let's look at other options to see what's the best we can do in this situation. But if I go to a place where I feel actually I can't make these changes and I feel I don't have the skills to be able to work long term in that environment to be able to make those changes, then I can go elsewhere and say actually I can focus on something else. And I know that's not realistic for every single person, but that's the way I tend to look at it from my life. Is if I'm going to be in a situation where I'm going to be complaining every single day about my managers or what I'm doing or what I have to do, then is it worthwhile for me to keep doing that, or can I go and make better change somewhere else? And so yeah, generally for me, I tend to think of it as we're there to advocate for the animals if we're working in those roles. And so we should never, ever lose that, or it should never become, after 20 years of doing it, to still be saying, my job is to go to work and do whatever it is that the animals feel happy about. I think that's just such a great philosophy. And that really is something that sticks with me, is when I'm doing things, doesn't matter if I've been doing it for so many years, or it's another dog or another parrot or another consult. The goal is, regardless of all the human deadlines that we put on, when I go to a situation, if they say, well, we're going to need to train this by this date, we need to do this, I always come back to, for me, is how does the animal feel in this situation? And Suzanne Clothier, another trainer, I heard her speak once, and she said on stage, do you ever ask yourself the question, how is this for you? So when we're training or we're doing something with a dog or a learner, we should always be asking the question, how is this for you? And if the animal could talk or reply back, what would they say? And that's something I'm always thinking about. When I'm doing something, how is this for you? And in every moment, as much as I can, and if I start thinking, well, the answer wouldn't be something I want to hear, then maybe I need to stop. And maybe it's my responsibility to have a difficult conversation with a manager or someone who's paying me to be there and say, actually, it's not realistic. I'm sorry, I can't get the behaviors you want in the next 6 weeks. I can get them in the next 3 months. And if you would like, then I'm happy to do that. But if you want them in the next 6 weeks, I'm not the right person for you. Maybe I wasn't as good doing that, and I'm still practicing that. So if I go into a situation, I might find myself in knots where I've not followed my own kind of ideals. I try and practice that as much as I can and get better at it. So I think the more we do it and the more we practice, we can get better and better at those things. And for some people, going to work, they can't just turn around and say to the manager, well, I won't be able to do this in the next 6 weeks and I can't help you in this situation, because they rely on that income in order to do that. So I'm lucky that I've managed to get to a situation where if I feel I need to say, sorry, I can't do this, I'm confident that I can try and pay my mortgage, feed the animals and do all the rest in a different route. For some people, that's not realistic. So I think everyone's going to have their own goals and what they can and can't do. I don't know if that really answers your question.
It was a hard question, Shreg, and I don't think there is at least I haven't come across an answer to it that works for everyone yet. There's so many variables in each situation. So I think you answered it really well. And it makes me think about something that's valuable to talk about, and reminds me of recently someone went and saw you present at Clicker Expo in the UK. And they posted a video on our private ATA Animal Training Academy Facebook page, and they said you were talking about the importance of finding a community.
Yep.
And they said it reminded them of ATA, and that's why they posted it in there. But potentially that's addition to the answer you gave, which I thought was fantastic, is that having a supportive network of people to help you remember that you're the voice for your animals in those situations can be helpful. What do you think?
Definitely. I think that's so big. The more support we have and the more of a community that we build and we support each other, it's only going to benefit the animals that we care for. So the more we close off and we're more individual, we're going to have less of an influence. So I think the more community people can be part of and build, I think it's going to get to that end goal that we're working towards, which is improving the lives of the animals that we care for. So definitely. And I think one other thing that I'd add to this is not to forget that when we're talking about the science of behavior change, we're not just talking about the four-legged or the feathery animals that we work with. Those principles apply just as much to the human next to us as they do with the animals, because often we think when we're talking about teaching or training animals, we're thinking about using positive reinforcement, giving them choice, control, arranging the environment to set them up for success. When we think about talking to our manager, we think of a completely different philosophy, or we're talking about teaching the caregiver. We start thinking about it in very different ways, more constructs. We think about, well, we have to do this, we have to change this, we have to try and change them and the human's mind. But we don't go into a training session thinking, I need to change my dog's mind, I need to change my dolphin's mind. We talk about changing behavior. And so I'm a big fan of leaving the mind alone and letting that be private to the individual. And we're not qualified psychologists, we're focused on the application or technicians of behavioral principles. So let's use those with the people that we work with. So if it's your manager, take a step back and think, how can I arrange the environment for reinforcement and both consequences and antecedents to change the behavior that I'm looking for, which could be giving you a few more weeks to do something. And so taking a step back and thinking, how can I apply the same principles of positive reinforcement, empowerment, choice, arranging the environment, setting things up for success with the humans, makes a big difference too.
Great information. And I've written a ton of notes here, and I could keep pummeling you with questions, but we're going to move on to the next thing we wanted to talk about. And this is really important, and you've mentioned it so many times already in this podcast. So this will just be building on, I think, everything that you've already talked about, because you and I discussed the huge value of us, once again, building upon everything you've already said, talking about the topic of choice and control. Can you build on this topic for us, Chirag? What it is? What is choice and control? Why it's important? Where are we currently with these concepts and ideas, and where are we going?
Yeah, so one of the first people I heard this from was Susan Friedman talking about this in her presentation. But when we think about behavior, that's influenced the consequences. But when we behave, we're changing the environment in a way that's either going to gain us outcomes or some kind. Now, often when we're working with animals, we're very good, or if you think about children, how many times are we constantly suppressing behavior? Don't do that. Nope, do it this way. Well, that's not right. I would do it this way. How many times do you hear all of these things? And all of these things that we're doing is we're almost taking control away. So behavior, the function of behavior, the reason for behavior is to change the environment. But yet we're often really stopping animals from changing the environment. When they're chewing the furniture, when we're chewing the curtains, they're peeing on the furniture, they're screaming or they're biting. Those things aren't a problem. They're a problem for us. But from the animal's point of view, those behaviors have function. The animals are behaving for a reason. They're changing the outcome of the world they live in. And that's their biology. That's not something that someone invented or made the animals do. Animals are born being able to use their behavior to change the environment in which they live in. And so for me, when they change the environment they're able to live in, that's control. So in a training session, when we're applying the natural principles of behavior, and often people think of learning theory or behavioral principles as being invented by Skinner in a laboratory, and that's not true. Skinner discovered the principles. He didn't invent them. The principles of behavior science are naturally occurring phenomenon that occur because we live on this planet Earth. And so it's not someone invented these principles of behavior science, that reinforcement strengthens behavior. Skinner studied why does behavior happen more often, or how does it change under certain conditions, and he was trying to understand nature. So when he described these principles of positive reinforcement, extinction, punishment, he wasn't making things up. He was applying labels essentially to naturally occurring phenomena. So when we're working with animals, if we say that behavior changes the environment and that allows some kind of control for the animal, so I do it this way, I do it that way, and I have small elements of control, when we're taking these natural principles and applying them in what we label as training situations, then if we're just restricting the animal from being able to have some control over the environment, we're making them do it in one way, that kind of takes away that element of having that control. So for me, I think when we're working with animals, if control is a reinforcer, then it's something we should be ensuring that we allow for the animals to have opportunity to have access to making those choices within a situation. And they're never really going to have full control, full choice, because when we live with an animal, we kind of take away lots of choices and control from them. So when I have two parrots, really, they don't have control over when they eat, if they have access to water, if they can reproduce, if they can have social contact. I have a pet dog. Ultimately, I have all control over what he eats, if he gets access to food, if he gets access to water, if he gets access to social interactions. And so when we talk about needing to be more in control of our animals, I think that concept is just very outdated and doesn't make sense to me, because we already control the animal's life. And so if we say that a part of living animals that have emotions and feelings and they're able to think, that control is an important aspect of life. And if we look at things like depression and look at learned helplessness or controls taken away and look at the negative effects that causes on the learners or those animals, even humans, when we talk about animals that are always anxious or nervous and that are depressed, or we label them with these different conditions, often taken away the opportunity for them to have control of the environment. When something scary happens, they can't move to a safe place because there's only certain situations available for them. So looking at ways when we're training that allow the animal to be able to operate on the environment and be able to say yes, but also say no, I think is so important. I think we've always been focused on how can I make the animal say yes or do what I want them to do. I think it's so important that we also embrace the no's. And so we respect those no's. We don't just say, well, the animal said no, so I just need to hold the target stick out again. But be asking, why did the animal say no? And so why did the animal stop doing that? And I mentioned this earlier where I said it could be social stuff going on within a group. It could be pain. It could be there's so many things that could be happening. It could be that what we're asking the animal to do is not very reinforcing. And so rather than just saying, we're going to take all the food away and the animal has to do this in order to get food, we give them access to food and they can go off and get that free food. And we have to change the environment to make it more reinforcing for them to be with us. I think that's the way I look at it. Is for me, the philosophy of animals and working with animals is first and foremost, they don't have choice to live with us, whether they're a wild animal or domestic animal. And just because we call them domestics, again, doesn't mean that they're programmed to know what human beings are. They're not programmed to know how every single human hand will feel when they touch them. And so whether they're domestic or they're exotic or they're wild, they don't have a choice to live with us. And we're the ones who make those choices. Whether it's a rescue, we label animals as rescue animals. And then for some reason, we want the animals to be grateful that we're caring for them. Well, the animal didn't end up in a rescue situation because of something they did. It's because humans put them there in the first place. And so whether that we're a human going into a rescue place and helping animals, we shouldn't go in thinking, I work in a rescue shelter or a rescue center, so I'm doing a great thing, because we're the ones who have the choice to either go and work for a charity or rescue or not work for them. Those animals don't have any choice whether they're going to be there or not. They have to be there. And so part of my philosophy of animal training is animals don't have a choice to do what we do. So surely, because we control everything around them anyway, rather than trying to become more dominant or trying to control them even more, we need to give control back. We need to be able to, as much as possible, when we take a dog for a walk, let's see if they want to walk left or right. Let's see if they want to go left, why do we need to go right? Why do we always need to walk in one direction? Why do we always need to go to a park? When we take a bird out, or we ask the bird, if I go downstairs and I'm going to take my bird out to the aviary, and I go downstairs and I ask my bird to step up on my hand, and the bird says no by not stepping up, or they walk away, do I re-cue stepping up or say, well, I'm going to ask them one more time? Or do I just say, well, they didn't step up. There's nothing else in the environment that I can see that influenced that. Maybe today they're going to sit on a perch indoors for a couple of hours, and I'll ask them again later on if they want to go out, as opposed to, well, they have to go out. And so if I pick up the dog lead and the dog stays in the bed, then do I walk over and say, come on, let's go for a walk? Or do I just put the dog lead down and go and do something else? And so I think all of those things are so important. And little things like, rather than just taking out a food bowl and popping food down for your animals, have a little toy, or it could be an enrichment device that you have available to them. And if they go up to that enrichment device and pick it up, or they do something with it, we walk over and we get a handful of food and stuff it in the device. And so the animal can say, I'd like to eat now. And if they go up to that toy and they bring it, and we can say that's not going to be realistic, because if I have to work or I have to go somewhere, we might not be able to provide those opportunities all the time. So we may just take that switch, that toy away, and put it into a cupboard. But when we do have, if I'm at home all day today, rather than just pop the food bowl down twice a day, I'll leave out that toy. And anytime my dog goes up to that toy, I'll take a handful of his food and pop it in there and give him the choice of when he can go and access that food, as opposed to me just popping it down twice. Or I'll have the dog lead down, and if he walks over and goes to the dog lead, I might go for a short walk at that time. And so we always think about different ways that we can allow the animal to say, well, let's go for a walk now, or let's eat now, as opposed to saying we have to do it now. And like I say, it's not always going to be realistic that the animal can have what they want when they want, but we can try and give as much control back as we can in the situations we can.
So it kind of comes back to the previous question about thinking about what's happening in the present moment as opposed to what our end goals are.
Exactly.
nice full circle there. And once again, I've got a million questions, but we will press on. But before we do, I just want to say you're really good at explaining this stuff, Shrek. You've got a really good way of getting ideas out of your head and making them make sense and breaking them down and making them easy to understand. So I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you very much.
Sadly, we are nearly at the end, but that's okay because we're heading into one of my favorite parts of the podcast show, and this part's called Story Time. Shrek, can you please share with everyone listening two or three stories from your experience training animals so far and some of the important lessons that these have taught you?
Yeah, so let's go for a human one. So I started off running puppy classes, doing one-to-one training sessions with primarily dog owners, pet owners. And when I was running classes and I was going to do these one-to-one sessions, often we'd say, well, the animal's the easy part, the human's the hard part. And we're talking about questions like what happens when people don't always turn up to a class on time? Should we make them wait outside for a few more minutes, or they're not listening to us? We label them as sort of stubborn, or they don't care about their animals, et cetera, et cetera. And so I remember this story really made me rethink about the way we relate to people and where we treat them in these situations as learners. I was running a puppy class and we had a family sign up. And the first week, I remember the kids, when I say kids, they were probably 18 to 20 plus. They turned up with the puppy, a German Shepherd puppy. And after week one, they stopped coming to the classes. But the mum in the family turned up every week. But she would turn up late. And every week, we'd ask people to bring with them a selection of treats and toys and things like that. And there are certain things that she wouldn't bring with them. So one of the philosophies that we have in our classes is when people turn up, if they ever turn up late or if they forget something or they don't bring it, we never emphasize on the negative. So we just say, sure, there's a table over there. You can go help yourself to any treats that you want. If you've forgotten your water bowl and water, we don't say, oh, you forgot your water bowl. As they come in, if they don't pop a water bowl down, we'll ask them, have you got some water with you? If they say no, we just walk over and give them a water bowl. We don't try and punish them for not doing these things. And so if they turn up late, as soon as there's a moment, we open the door, let them in, help them settle in, and we just make it an exercise. So if it's a dog training class, we'll say to everyone else, we've got another dog walking in now. It's a great opportunity for your dogs to learn. When the environment changes, they can still be nice and calm and go lie in their bed as opposed to start barking and jumping up. So if you're at the vets, people are going to walk in and out all the time. If you're at home, your dog might be sleeping. You might get a visitor walking. So we just make it into a great training opportunity. And so this lady turns up, she completes the 6 weeks of class. And if we're trying to read her mind, we might say things like, well, she just didn't enjoy it. Maybe she didn't care. She's never going to come back again, rather than focus on behavior. And we never know what humans are thinking. We can make up as many stories as we want. And so she turns up to class, like I say, for all the 6 weeks. At the end of the 6 week course, she comes up and says to me, I'd like to book some one-to-one training sessions because I think that would work better. And I was surprised that she wanted to carry on training just because of the little stories that I'd been making up in my mind about this person and this situation. So I turn up to her house for the one-to-one training session and she says, okay, so I'd like to book 20 training sessions. So 20 one-to-one training sessions, quite expensive. And that's quite a lot to book in one go, because I said, do you want to just book a few, see how you get on? You may not need 20. Then we can just assess it as we go on. He said, no, I'd like to book 20 now. My husband's kind of said, he's given me the money and said, let's do 20. And it turns out that the husband is in the room next door and he's basically terminally ill. He's got cancer and he's essentially going to die in the next sort of coming month or two. And they bought this dog, or the kids have bought this dog, this German Shepherd, a family, it's an Asian family. They've never really had dogs in the family. Their views on maybe dogs is slightly different to different cultures, have different views. And so this mum had been left with this dog because now they've got this German Shepherd in the garden and kids aren't walking this dog. She sees this dog, she cares for the dog, but she's never really been around dogs. She doesn't know what to do. And so she's saying to me, well, they don't take the dog for a walk. They don't feed the dog. So I'm having to do this. I don't know really what dogs eat. I don't really know what dogs do. But my husband has said he wants to make sure things are taken care of. And that really opened my eyes to thinking, wow, this lady is looking after her husband. She has to run to a hospital anytime something happens. And it's just on that moment. on the spur. If your husband is sick, she needs to get there really quickly. And she's bringing this dog to training classes. So if we had made it difficult for her, if we'd punished her behavior for coming to class, or we'd said something in a sarcastic way, or we'd made her wait outside longer when she turned up, or we made her feel bad for not bringing the treats or forgetting the treats again. When people do things, there's a reason. Their behavior is influenced by their environment, just like animals' behavior is influenced by their environment. The same principles apply to humans. And it really highlighted for me the importance of focusing on a positive reinforcement approach as opposed to a punishment-based approach. Because so often we can think, well, that person doesn't care, and we make up all these stories. We can't read minds. And so we don't know what's going on in people's lives. We don't know what's going on in our animals' lives. And so often we focus on a positive reinforcement approach without trying to make people feel bad about things that have gone wrong. We don't know the larger picture. So for me, that story really illustrates an impact on how important it is to focus on, we talk about positive reinforcement training, but to really focus on good positive reinforcement approach and empowering approach, as opposed to, well, we'll punish this because that person doesn't care, or the animal's being stubborn, because often there's lots of other reasons why they do those things.
And this is about a human coming to your class. I feel, as I'm listening to you tell the story, and other people might be taking away different things, but something that I'm taking away from it is this thing that we do, and you've identified, you do it, I do it, everyone I know does it, is we tell the story in our mind that makes the most sense.
Exactly, exactly. We create stories. I think from a science point of view, I don't know is a great answer. So if someone says something, or if there's something out there that I don't know about, I think it's important to remember that we think this could be happening, but actually the answer is I don't know. And I, for me personally, I'm quite content now at saying, well, I don't know, until we know that information. Yes, there's lots of possibilities, and these are possibilities, but that's all they are, rather than creating a story and trying to fill that void with things. So if I'm teaching, I remember when I started doing presentations and workshops and teaching, I would be standing up doing a presentation, and I'd kind of be trying to work out what people are they happy, are they not enjoying this, oh my god, that person's got their phone out, and so maybe I'm doing such an awful job. So I'm trying to present my presentation, but I'm also having this conversation in my head about what people are thinking. And it kind of, over time, I've got much better at this. But now it doesn't bother me. If someone goes to pick up a phone, they walk out of the room, my mind isn't thinking, well, that person mustn't be enjoying it. All I say to myself is, I don't know what's going on in that person's life. Maybe their partner's sick. Maybe they need to take an urgent call. At least they were there for the first 20 minutes or something. I focus on what I'm doing. And again, it comes back to mindfulness. I think what I talked about earlier is it really trying to focus on, rather than having that conversation in our head constantly running, where we're constantly thinking about what's happening in the future or the past, we're really giving our full focus on the now. And that was actually one of my favorite books of 2017, was when I read The Power of Now. It really kind of brought that side home for me, is how often we're constantly having this little conversation in our heads, and we're, a lot of it's made up. We don't actually know what's going on, but we fill those voids with those stories.
And that is, correct me if I'm wrong, it's Eckhart Tolle?
Yeah, Eckhart Tolle.
Eckhart Tolle, I said that incorrectly. And I've read that book myself. I never really drawn a connection with animal training until now. But it's completely relevant. Thank you for that.
It's funny you say that, because a lot of my reading is more sort of scientific books and sort of factual books. And then I read this book, so I try and think I'm open-minded. So I'll look at things I don't normally do. So I bought the audio book, and I became addicted. I've listened to it like seven or eight times over. It's constantly playing. And the more I listen to it, the more I start thinking, oh my God, there's so many correlations and links to animal training and the way I think about philosophy of animal training. And I see more and more of that actually from some of the stuff I read in that book. And so, yeah, if people haven't read it, initially the first read, you might think, oh my God, what's this? But reading it, and also once you read it once, maybe a year later, go back, and with the new information that you've learned over that year, you'll see the information in the book completely differently to what you would have 1 year ago. So I definitely think, for me, it's been a really good book, and I love learning new things from it every time I read it.
Very cool. It's I've got 1.5 audiobooks to get through, and then I've never listened to it before I read it. I'm going to re-listen to that book. And with all of us, just before we move on, this is the same with our animals, isn't it? We make up stories about our animals.
All the time. And I catch myself doing it. The animal's being spiteful, or they're doing this, or maybe they hate me, or they're doing this. And we really don't know. We don't know what a human is thinking, let alone trying to work out what an animal is thinking. Yes, they think. I don't deny that animals think. But the more time we spend trying to work out what they're thinking, we really don't know. And so when it does come to, often when we turn that off and we really focus on what the animal's doing and arranging the environment so that we can give them as many happy moments and we can focus on giving as much control as possible and changing behavior that way, I think it makes a big difference. And actually, rather than trying to think, I have to know what the animal's thinking, rather than just be content of going, at this moment, I really don't know. There could be these 5 or 6 different options, but I can sit here all night long trying to work out and create all these little stories. But actually, I don't know why that dog backs away when you raise your hand in the air. And maybe that dog's never been hit. But often it makes us feel happier to think, or not happier, but somehow we relate to that animal more. We think, oh, he's been abused. And we kind of become more sympathetic towards that learner. And so the amount of times you hear people say he's a rescue. But those labels also then hold the animal back. If we didn't label the animal as a rescue, would they be very different now than they were if with that label? Often I think we label them as rescue animals and then we kind of hold them back because they're rescue, they behave in this way. But actually they may be behaving in this way because of the environment and the current conditions as well as the past conditions.
It's a challenging skill to do, and I have been practicing it throughout my journey as a trainer and person as well. And you said there that we kind of feel good if we create these reasons. And maybe we're going into more of a psychology aspect than animal training aspect right now. From my understanding, and maybe just quickly before we move on, we kind of have a need to do that though, don't we? We have a need to fill that gap and close that loop in our mind.
I don't know is the answer. We do it. I know I can relate to the fact that we do it. So whether it's a biological need, I don't know. But we do it. I know I do it. But the more I think about it and practice it, I try and work. For me, having the idea that actually I don't know is a good enough answer. And actually, I'm quite relaxed and happy at I don't know. So for me, when I work with an animal and someone spends the first 10, 15, 20 minutes telling me what they think about the animal, the hard life the animal's had, what's fact and what's fiction, what's made up. And within that 20 minutes or half an hour that we're sitting there sympathizing about how hard this animal's had a life, we could have actually made changes, which would have meant we've got a happier animal and a happier human. And so, yeah, I don't know whether it's a biological need. I hear people say that all the time. But yeah, I think it's something we can definitely work on and change in our own behaviours.
Yeah, and I don't know either. I've read stuff like, you know, if you watch a TV program and just before they finish to go to the commercials, they leave you with a cliffhanger. And I experience kind of like an uneasiness, like I really want to like answer that question.
Yeah, but is that how much learning goes into that? So from an early age, is that something that if you look at your parents or you look at people around you, you look at situations, is that something that is taught to us through those modelling and how they behave? So if you've got a young child who from a young age you teach that in these situations, it's fine to not know rather than create a story and they hear their parents create a story. And so almost that becomes what is normal or what we do in that situation. So is it a human need or is it an early learning influence? Again, I don't know is the answer, but it's a question that I'm constantly asking is how much is learned. And I saw, again, it always makes me think, I was watching a TV program in the UK that came out on the BBC and it was about children and their relation to gender identity. And again, this it kind of goes off topic, but I think it relates to animal training really well. And I use this in my presentations now, a clip of this is they went to a professor at one of the prominent universities studying brain scans and brain development. And they asked her and they said, let's look at scans and what differences are there early on in the brain of a young male brain to a female brain. And her reply was, there's very little difference from the modern research and the information that they have in terms of the brain and the areas of the brain that develop. There's very little difference. And she actually said something like, what happens once the child starts to learn things and interact and culture in the culture they're in and things that happen shape and change how that brain develops and what they learn. And so often when people say, well, he was born knowing he's a girl and she's a boy, actually, a lot of the current research is now saying You can't say, well, that person behaves like this because she's a girl, because her brain is wired that way. Actually, the brains are very similar. And what happens afterwards shapes what parts of the brain changes in what ways. And they also did an experiment where they got kids. So these were young babies. And so they got female and male babies. And they dressed them in the opposite sex and they changed their names. So they got, say they got Tom, and they turned Tom into Jody, and they got Kate, and they turned Kate into Tom by just dressing them in the opposite colors clothes and changing the way their hair was combed. And then they got these adults to come in. And so they had this child on a mat on the floor with lots of toys surrounding the child. And they had the adult come in and interact with the child. And what they saw was when they walked in, when they interacted, if they interacted with a girl, they'd pick up or what we label as girl toys, and they'd interact with those toys. When they walked in and they'd pick up off the floor boy toys. And when they asked, why did you do that? People kind of said, well, I didn't do it purposefully. It was just that the boy toy was closer to him than the girl toy. Or I just picked up the toy that I thought he would like. He showed more interest in the action figure than he did the doll. But actually, that wasn't true, because they picked up the action figure and they shoved it in the child's face, as opposed to giving the child the opportunity to play with the doll too. And they were saying how from that early age, we say if men are better at, this may not be true, just making examples, you hear people going, men are better at problem solving and women are better at doing this. Are those genetically predisposed things that people, skills, or are they things that children learn to be better at because from a young age, people will interact with boys in a more physical way or these kinds of toys that allow them to develop these skills, whereas with girls, maybe they offer these other toys that allow them to develop a different skill set. So when we say, well, girls are better at this and boys are better at this, is it a genetic thing or is it a learned behavior? And the more and more we look at things, it isn't nature or nurture. There's both elements to it. There's a genetic component, and we're learning so much how much learning influences biology and physiology, how the brain is able to, is plastic, and how it can change. And so we can't really change what's inside of the animal, but what we can do is we can really focus on how the animal interacts with the learning environment, how that makes changes. So for me, that's why I'm really fascinated in learning and behavior and how behavior interaction with the environment changes things.
So back to the rescue dog. So if we've got a rescue dog, then we're saying it's a rescue dog. We're potentially, because we've created that reality, we're creating learning opportunities for that animal to be, air quotes, because I'm not describing behaviors here, using a label. We're providing an environment for it to be a rescue dog, because we're behaving in ways that we would expect a rescue dog would need.
Exactly. So we're not focusing on what the dog does. We're focusing on the picture that we've created with that label rescue. So if I say, okay, so this is a rescue dog, do people move slower? Do they produce things? Do they isolate the animal from more stimuli? Whereas if I say I'm going to bring in a confident dog, a well-socialized dog, people are less likely to move their chairs slowly. They'll just get off their chair without thinking twice. Whereas if I say, okay, I'm going to bring in a dog into this room and the dog is very sensitive, how will people change their behavior? Now, then how does that affect the learning that the animal never gets exposed to fast-moving chairs? They never get exposed to things. And just because I said it's a rescue dog, it doesn't suddenly change what, it's still a dog, and it's just a dog that ended up living in a kennel for 6 months. But that dog living in a kennel for 6 months might have actually been better than a pet dog who's lived in a back garden for 6 months. The dog who's lived in a kennel has been exposed to way more people and way more situations than the dog in a garden. So when we add these labels, we kind of make an assumption and say, well, this animal must have had this kind of life, or we have to do this. And we're almost living the story in our mind as opposed to what is the animal is actually capable of doing. And we can hold them back. And we also change our behavior. There's a really an excellent study, and the name of the researchers goes out of my head as I say this, but they basically took a group of children and they gave a fake IQ test. And they said to the teacher, these group of students are destined to do amazing. They're going to be intelligent. This group of students are not destined to do very well based on this fake IQ test. And they watched how the teacher changed their behavior. And when they watched the teacher's behavior, they found that she would interpret the behavior differently. So say she asked Mary a question and Mary was in the intelligent group. She said, Mary, what's 1 + 1? And Mary said, is it 2? And then she asked John, and John's in the group that's not so intelligent. And she asked John, John, what's 1 + 1? And John said, is it 2? Now, the behavior is exactly the same. Is it 2? But when they asked the teacher, what did you think? The teacher would say, Mary is such a thoughtful child. She thinks before she answers. Whereas if they asked her about John, she would say, well, John isn't very intelligent because it took him so long to answer the question. Yet the pause behavior is the same with both the learners. Do we do that with our animals? Do we label the animals as sensitive and confident? And then they do something. And because that's a confident learner, we say, oh yeah, that learner is so intelligent. They did it this way. Other animals, because they're sensitive, they did it this way. And also they noticed that when the teacher was teaching, she would give more eye contact, more smiles, more head nods, more opportunities to answer the questions for the students that she thought was more intelligent than the students that weren't so intelligent. And she didn't do this purposefully. She didn't do this because she was planning to do it. She did this unknowingly. And only because they have observers watching her behavior and video cameras, they realize this information. And so how many times are we behaving unconsciously, almost like without knowing that we're doing these things? So when we say this animal's aggressive, how do we walk? What do we do? We may think, oh, I'm behaving normally. But actually, if we watch ourselves back on video, the way we put a hand in our bait bag, the way we take a step probably is different around the animal that is labeled as aggressive compared to the animal who we label as friendly. And so when we have those labels, often we change our behavior and we arrange the environment differently. But we almost say, well, it's the animal that's doing it. It's something inside the animal. But actually, we've almost changed the environment or set the environment.
So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like saying, it's like saying it's a corvid, so it can't stand still.
Exactly. It's almost, our corvids don't stand still. Well, look, see, every time I go to a training session, they're always jumping, they're flying, they're moving fast, so all corvids move fast. And then almost it becomes, well, they can't stand still, we have to do this. I hear it's sea lions as well. They say, well, you have to be really fast, a Californian sea lion, because they'll bite you if you stop or you pause. But I've seen people train them and work with them and teach them to do lots of in between. It's just a behavior in between being asked to do something, standing or stationing calmly. Then you get to do the next behavior. It becomes part of that repertoire. They learn to do it. It's part of this reinforced behavior. And so I think, yeah, definitely.
Such a great answer there. And really, really, really enjoyed that conversation. We will go to the final question. And maybe you've already answered this multiple times in this podcast already. But Shrek, could you just take us all into the future now and share what you would really like to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the animal training world?
I wish I could take you into the future. What would I like to see happen in animal training in the future? That's a really good question. I would love to see, from a training perspective, interacting with professional trainers, I would really like to see a big change in, it's happening more and more now, in terms of training is thought of as part of an animal care program. So Ken Ramirez teaches this. He says, just as one would not consider developing an animal care program without a nutritional component, a social component, an environmental component, a health component, you shouldn't consider having a behavior management program without a behavior component. And so behavior and training isn't something we do to make the animal do stuff, but all animals on this planet behave. And so therefore, our behavior, what we call training, changing, managing behavior, should be part of anyone who cares for an animal. It should be part of that program. So yeah, we often think about training our animals for agility, obedience, teaching them to do this, that, or the other, but we don't think of it as just living with the animal. And I think first and foremost, training should be just that, managing behavior for day-to-day life, just living everything that we want, rather than using training for benefiting humans. So we train the animals so our lives are easier. We train them so they're more obedient or they're easier to live with. Actually, we use training, or we think about training, every interaction we have with the learner, and it just becomes a part of life, as opposed to using it for some kind of end outcome that benefits us. So I think it'd be nice to have training as just part of an animal care program, as opposed to I either choose to train or I don't choose to train. And I still go to places and I hear people say, and this is not just zoos, I hear a companion, like dog trainer, say to me, oh yeah, I believe in having a natural relationship. I don't believe in this training stuff. And I hear zoos as well say to me, oh yeah, no, we like to keep it natural. We're not for this training. And I think it's just such a misunderstanding about what training actually is. And like I said, at one point in my conversation was, it's a natural phenomenon that occurs by living on this planet. And so when we live with animals, their behavior is going to change based on outcomes and the way we arrange the environment. So whether we choose to believe it or not, it's happening. So if we can educate ourselves about it, we can be in the driver's seat. Susan Snyder has a quote, ultimately knowing what drives us puts us in the driver's seat. And so understanding or knowing what drives us, knowing how behavior changes gives us more control, allows us to be able to use that information to both benefit further the lives of the animals that we care for and the people that we work with. So I think the science is just giving us information about how the universe naturally functions. So if we take the time to listen and learn and observe this information, we can be better and we can be in the driver's seat and have more control.
Such a good answer, and excited you brought up Susan Snyder because we are in discussion, so hopefully get here on a podcast in the future.
Oh, fantastic. You should definitely, anyone, if you get the chance to hear Susan Snyder speak, and definitely go and read her book, The Science of Consequences. I'd highly recommend having Susan here and be able to listen to her.
Yes, hopefully we will be bringing you that opportunity really shortly. Sadly, Chirag, that does bring us to the end. Before we wrap up, though, we've said it before, but let's just remind everyone listening where they can go to find out more information about yourself, what you do, and your activities over the coming wee while.
Yeah, so you can go on my website, which is domesticatedmanners.com. And if you're on Facebook, if you go to facebook.com/Chirag Patel DM, then that will take you to my professional page on Facebook. And I often post upcoming events, information, videos. I do live feeds. And so you guys can follow me on there.
Fantastic. And I will link to all of this from the podcast write up. So from myself and on behalf of everyone listening, Chirag, thank you so much for making time to come on the show today. It's been really appreciated.
Thank you for having me. It's just wonderful to be able to have these discussions.
Agree. And if you listening enjoyed this episode today and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about most positive, less intrusive ways of influencing behavior, then as mentioned at the start of the episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. Head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn all about how you can connect with like-minded, positive reinforcement-based animal trainers from around the globe. Whether you're training dogs, cats, other pets, birds, zoo animals, implementing techniques within your vet clinic or any other area where behavior management is required, then you will love all the different ways you can join in. Forums, WhatsApp chats, private Facebook group, members only live web classes is something for absolutely everyone, and we're really looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We'll wrap it up there. Thanks again so much for listening. But for now, we have to hit the road, Happy Toad. You'll be hearing from us again soon.